Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nicholas Behan III. Mickey and Peter will return in 2 weeks. On today's program, we will discuss hip-hop in the age of Trump with Shada Akbarian and MC Grand Scheme. Please stay with us. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on the Pacifica Network. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Nicholas Behan and Desiree McSwain.
We are welcoming today Shada Akbarian, a lecturer in the Department of Ethnic Studies at California State University East Bay. As a faculty member and critical race and gender theorist, Shada has materialized her passion for challenging social injustice across an assortment of courses, including Hip Hop Nation, Racism in America, the Black Cinematic Tradition, Interracial Sex and Marriage, Viewing Diversity, and Ethnic Writers. Her research entails an examination of hip-hop's evolution and industrialization in America, and the ways in which hip-hop serves as both a socio-political and cultural driving force for the Black community. Welcome, Shada.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We wanted to talk a little bit today about the current state of hip-hop in the Trump era. And some of the things that you, from your vantage point, that you see that hip-hop artists are doing to contribute to the resistance.
Definitely hip-hop is revisiting its socio-political intent from the past. And definitely within the Trump era, we see a lot of issues surfacing. And a lot of it has to do with challenging issues like white supremacy, patriarchy, hypermasculinity, misogyny, stuff that we're typically seeing with Trump at this point in time. And hip-hop is definitely revisiting some of the timeless messages of collective liberation and a fight for social justice.
Shada, tell us a little bit about what drove you to start studying hip-hop.
When I was working on my thesis, I actually was really interested in the idea of cultural appropriation, specifically within the context of hip-hop. So I actually was looking at Eminem, and I was curious as to why he was so accepted within the realm of hip-hop, especially being a white male. So I explored that, and during my exploration, looking at the historical backdrop of hip-hop, I really got immersed into the culture, and I was very fascinated by it.
Shada, this is Desiree. That brought up a question in my mind about our situation in the music industry in the Bay Area with G-Eazy and him being a white rapper and him becoming the face of the Bay Area and our hip-hop scene and just being totally globally received as though he's almost one of the first to come out of here. How do you feel about that?
I definitely see a major explosion of cultural appropriation in hip-hop at this point. It's very different if you enter into the realm of hip-hop and you respect the integrity of the culture and you follow along with the guidelines in hip-hop, which is typically to bring about awareness and to respect cultural boundaries. But we don't really see that with appropriators at this point. So it's kind of disappointing to see folks like G-Eazy or Malcolm Moore being the face of hip-hop. Yeah. It's truly distorting the culture. And based on my research, there is some psychosocial ramifications associated with cultural appropriation. There's definitely a threat to cultural distinctiveness in terms of how the Black community might perceive appropriation of hip-hop done by, let's say, a white rapper, for example.
Shada, for our listeners, do you think you could define cultural appropriation?
It's essentially taking something from another culture and making it your own. It happens not just with music, it happens with fashion. We see, for example, Polynesian patterns in Adidas, for example, not acknowledging where the roots come from, just taking it and essentially defacing it. And just taking the aesthetic pleasure and leaving the integrity behind.
How different is that from, say, if I'm a young Afghan who's grown up in the midst of wars, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to appropriate hip-hop to speak to the kind of cultural, political situation that's going on in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And, U.S. imperialism.
I wouldn't consider that cultural appropriation, because what you're doing is you're following along with the guidelines that is really makes up organic hip hop, and that's to stand for social justice and to challenge injustice, right? So people from all marginalized communities, not just locally but globally, gravitate towards this, and it's used as a vessel to challenge the oppression. So we see that even in spaces where there's, you know, global warfare, we can connect it to domestic warfare, people who challenge domestic warfare. So I definitely don't consider that cultural appropriation, because they're speaking on their experience. And in hip hop, keeping it real and authentic is very critical, especially with respect to race and place.
I also wanted to get your take on the recent release by A Tribe Called Quest, their return to the music industry, and their very successful return too, and sort of how you see that album in the context of the resistance against Trump.
Definitely very relevant, and it was great to see A Tribe Called Quest come back into the space of hip-hop. It's much needed, especially in a time like this when it's been so diluted. And obviously, messages that are embedded within the old school, like what Tribe Called Quest has contributed to hip-hop, is timeless. It can elevate time and space. It can extend beyond time and space. So it's definitely relevant, and I appreciate what they've been doing.
Shada, I think what makes cultural appropriation so complex in the context of hip hop is the fact that a lot of people feel that there's not really an ethnic root to hip hop because of the diaspora and because of us being here in America now and us almost having to create our own thing. So to them, a lot of other people might even consider that as American culture, period. So they do think it's their culture and they don't think that they're appropriating anything. How could you explain that to somebody and really explain to them that it is cultural appropriation, though it has stemmed from American society?
That's a great question. A lot of times people don't understand that there is a significant cultural backdrop to hip hop. So even in a class like Hip Hop Nation that I teach, I really do focus on it being a form of Black identity. It's a form of Black cultural capital. So I stem it back to even West Africa with the Ghanaian roots, right? And the griots. Typically, students get pretty surprised about it because they see how it's evolved and they start to see how it could be a major problem. But it's definitely overlooked. And people, I think, they kind of hesitate to even accept that it is a Black art form and it is a Black cultural development. And they struggle to deal with that.
You know, I got to ask you about what has become almost an iconic image of Kanye West in Trump Tower, standing awkwardly next to Trump and, frankly, getting played. Mm-hmm. Sort of wondering about your take on that and a question that a lot of hip-hop fans have, which is, what's up with Kanye?
I won't lie, I was a fan of Good Morning, but, you know, he has changed quite a bit. And what you explain right there is an example of what's called multicultural white supremacy. You take someone, for example, Black or brown, and you place them in a space of white supremacy. That's actually far more problematic than seeing someone who's white actually representing that. So I see that as a major issue. And Kanye has definitely evolved. I'm definitely not a fan of his sampling of Nina Simone in Blood on the Leaves. That was really disturbing, because you take something like Strange Fruit and you pretty much deface it and embed it in a context of misogyny and sexism, and that's a problem. Kanye and the fact that he is the face of hip hop at this point, it's definitely disappointing.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with Nicholas Bayham and Desiree McSwain. And Shada's going to stick around with us. And after the musical break, we'll be joined by Grand Scheme.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Project Censored radio show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nicholas Bayham III in studio with my co-hosts Nolan Higdon, Desiree McSwain, and we've got our guests, Shada Akbarian and MC Grand Scheme. Shada is a lecturer for the Department of Ethnic Studies at California State University East Bay, who teaches a course called Hip Hop Nation. Maurice Jones, a.k.a. Grand Scheme, is from San Jose, California, and has been a writer, performer, and hip-hop artist, MC, since 1990. From 1999 to 2012, Grand Scheme lived in Fresno before returning to the San Francisco Bay Area. GrandScheme.com is his website. It's currently under construction and will feature an entire underground catalog produced mainly by The Eclectic, a longtime producer and best friend. Welcome, Shada and Grand Scheme. Thank you very much for being with us. So we want to get into a few questions with you, Grand Scheme, about what you're building right now in the current political climate as a part of the resistance to Trump.
Mainly just continuing to write. I've had the opportunity over the past year and a half or so to do four or five speaking engagements and one performance at Hayward State and Shada's Hip Hop Nation class, really just building with the students there, doing open forum discussions and, you know, trying to come up with solutions about what's going on with hip hop and just continuing to spread the message and the love.
Grand Scheme, why don't we talk a little bit about the current state of hip hop, please? Where do we start, right? So what do you think about the current state of hip hop? Where is it headed right now?
In terms of where it's headed, I hope it's back to the roots of community and social activism. What we're seeing right now with in the world, in this country in particular with Trump, is kind of a return to that same sort of resistance. Just the Snoop video that we talked about earlier, where he's in a space now where he's making political statements, is some place that I hope hip hop is going, in an ideology that I hope we're starting to embrace a little bit more. But in terms of where it's headed, That's a difficult question. I mean, if you're into mainstream hip hop, you know, the future looks bleak in terms of just like the appropriation of hip hop and, you know, kind of with the raping of the culture by the industry. We're seeing the message, if any at all, being watered down and our people being misrepresented. But with the social and political climate going on right now, you know, hopefully that'll wake us up a little bit. I am starting to see that more. So hopefully that's where we're headed. I know that's where I am.
Grand Scheme, this is Desiree, and I'm so happy to have you on the show. And I've been looking forward to asking somebody this question. So hip-hop started, I mean, it definitely had many of its phases, but was mostly well-known for being hyper-masculine and political at the same time with NWA and such like that. Whereas now, in these days, it's pretty much effeminized, and it's a very effeminized movement with Young Thugs and stuff like that. So how can you speak to the transition it's made, and how do you feel about that transition?
I think the only way for some of these people who want to tear hip hop down is to attack black male masculinity. What we're seeing are artists who I think are being conditioned before they get deals or are put out there to act and behave and dress in that way. I feel like our masculinity as hip hop artists and men is something that's natural, that cannot be duplicated. When you're an appropriator and you cannot match that yourself, your goal at the end of the day is to attack that masculinity that makes you feel insecure. Unfortunately, they're probably always going to be able to find people who will purvey that image. But how I feel about it, I strongly dislike it. I think it sends the wrong message to our young men and women out here. I think what it does is it attacks the image of the black male and it promotes certain behaviors that we're not really going to get into right now.
This is Shada. Actually, my perspective on this whole hyper-masculine and sexist representation of hip-hop is it's funny how we see an incline in terms of activism and the rappers in today's mainstream who supposedly are about the movement, yet they continue to perpetuate the oppressor's message, right? Putting the women down, perpetuating sexism and misogyny. You can't say that you're part of a movement and you're trying to liberate your collective, yet at the same time put down people within that collective. That's not possible. So we definitely see an underrepresentation of women in hip-hop, unfortunately, and we still have a lot to take care of in terms of addressing the hyper-masculinity, the misogyny, the sexism, the homophobia, for that matter. These are all issues issues that need to be tackled, and they still haven't gone away. And we need to really kind of make sure that if we're going to talk about making these shifts in the culture and surfacing awareness, that that's something we have to also include in the conversation or the discourse for sure.
Grant Skim, I'm wondering if we can get a little flow from you here in the studio and maybe even something that you've been working on that's relevant to the resistance.
Sure. I'm changing my train of thought for the better. Feeling socioeconomic pressure that's beyond measure. Holding that dope in that paper thin overcoat freezing. Satan overseeing police holding open season. I'm from where brothers ain't mad at you, they gon' get even. Products of fast money, slow thinking. But still a child of the school that's knocking the hardest where the block's retarded. My partner's carcass was propped up on top of garbage. The carnage was on the news. How are you so confused? Oblivious to the fact this movement is overdue. Screw peace when the prerequisite is justice. We got fake leaders conducting covert intelligence among us. We say Black Lives Matter. That's not a racist move. Give me the same consideration police pay to you. That's all across the board. Life's hell facing 25s with L's in brick houses, no common doors. In the streets till I see daylight peeking. Probably might die chiefing if I do decide I'm leaving. Connected rhyme to reason. Hat matched the black Adidas. Left home without the stainless. Felt half anemic. Me in the streets talk. Late nights, deep thoughts. I'm waking up to stuff I wrote while I sleepwalked. Hip hop ain't dead, it's just unconscious. Respect due to street wisdom over thug logic.
Oh, thank you.
Wow. Thanks. So why don't you talk a little bit about the process that you take in terms of your writing or generating ideas? I would love to know a little bit more about that.
I try to stick away from what everybody else is doing. I mean, that said, there's not really much you can say in hip hop in terms of, and have it not have been said before. But I try to inject some intellectualism into it. I actually speak a lot from personal experience, which makes every track you do unique if you're just staying true to yourself. And just really convey a message of positivity.
Grand Scheme, how does your environment affect your writing and your lyricism? I know you're from San Jose, mm-hmm. and I know that there's not a large black demographic, and I know that there is a lot of socioeconomic issues out there as well, and a lot of racism. Does that affect your writing? Do you include that in your writing?
Oh, certainly, certainly. I'm a direct reflection artistically of everything I've been through and everything I see. And you're right, there's not a very large black population in the South Bay. I think that kind of affects the underground scene there, too, in that it's very, very diverse. So when you get out there and you start meeting and listening to and watching artists perform, what you're going to see is a wide array of different ideas and thoughts. I think a lot of it is on an intellectual and social level, where we're all just kind of speaking to each other as hip hop fans. And that's what makes the message a little bit better.
So I'm wondering if you are a part of a broader collective of Bay Area underground artists, and if there's some other underground artists in the Bay Area that, you want to point out and maybe encourage us to listen to.
Well, a lot of the guys that I do music with are underground. For instance, Persia, my man Eclectic, who does most of my production. Pasha, who actually is a resident of Northern California now, has been doing a lot of great things. Those are just kind of my immediate circle of family that I do music with.
All right. Thank you to both MC Grand Scheme and to Shade Akbarian. You're listening to the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a musical break, and we'll be right back with our guests, Shade Akbarian and Grand Scheme. Welcome back to the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nicholas Baham, and in studio we have Shada Akbarian and MC Grand Scheme. So, Grand Scheme, you gave us a little bit of a flow. I wonder if there's anything else that you want to share with us that you're working on today.
Sure. This is I Am Hip Hop. And what I'll do is just kind of preface it by telling you kind of the origins of where I got the idea from. Basically, what I'm doing with this piece is personifying hip hop, speaking on hip hop as the voice of hip hop itself. The whole idea stemmed from a conversation I was having with a friend of mine where he had the idea or the thought that humanity in itself is kind of the physical manifestation of the universe attempting to figure itself out. And I thought it would be cool to flip that on some hip hop stuff and kind of represent hip hop as the artistic manifestation of Black people trying to figure out their world. So this is what it would sound like. Alpha to the Omega, the genesis of a culture preceding the revelation that comes later. The voice born of a generation past tense, the doctrine that bears the forefathers' handprints. In essence, I am the words that paint the picture, the artistic vision and thoughts that illustrate scriptures. I am the truth when spoken, breathing new life in, a panoramic perspective through the wide lens of wise men. I'm not just music, I'm a collective conscience. One nation under one groove, nothing else beyond it. Paternally yours, I fathered your style, the wisdom of old age, the promise of the child is me. My heart beats the pulse of the streets, never flatlining. Long as I'm left to function in peace, I'm inspiration. The sixth and seventh sense, the catalyst that's converting vocab to calculus intelligently. This is the evidence. Call me Exhibit A, the scientific design, thinking against the grain. I'm the definition of abstract in black and white, the song of the fallen soldier lost to the afterlife. Me and this mic remain connected, so with or without it, what I communicate's effective. Knowledge of self, that is my sole mission. I am the universe's attempt to finally make sense of its own existence. The power to reverse engineer your mind, the sum total of two separate hemispheres combined. I am the answer to the question and the reason why, bridging the gaps between the two like an equal sign. The method to the madness, the key to the lock, unleashing this message to the masses. Believe it or not, I'm hip hop, the most poetic global phenomenon, the heart, the spirit, the soul, the ambiance. I am hip hop.
I love it. So, Grand Scheme, this is Shada. I want to know, do you think that hip-hop is dead? Because a lot of people want to know the answer to that question, right? Especially with the current state.
But hip-hop is not dead. I can't believe that. I can't operate under that premise. I do believe that it is in a state of sort of being unconscious. But I think that's largely just because of what the mainstream is giving casual fans of hip-hop or people who don't know much about hip-hop to consume, right? In order for hip hop to go where it needs to go, there needs to be more discussion and education about the culture itself. There has to be a certain level of, you know, respect for the culture and that we want to revive it and bring it back, you know, its original roots and intent. But no, by far, I don't think it's dead. I just believe maybe it's lost its voice or it's allowed other people to speak for it. But as, you know, as the socio-political climate changes and we begin to wake up as a people, I think the voice of hip hop will reflect that.
Grand Scheme, this is Desiree. I wanted to ask, how do you feel about the Remy Ma and Nicki Minaj beef in hip hop? That's something that is on the forefront. And I think probably largely because it's so male dominated that we haven't seen this in such a long time. And regardless of people's opinions of each rapper, I can say that I did agree with a lot of what Remy Ma said about misleading Black girls and stuff like that and really taking a stance. So how do you feel about that? Do you think that that was really needed for hip hop or for women in hip hop in general?
I do think Remy Ma's message was needed. And I also do love to see the fact that, you know, hip hop has sort of gone back to where we're battling instead of like hurting each other physically. One aspect of it I don't like is that I never really like to see two sisters tearing each other down. That kind of bothers me a little bit. But you know what? This is a male dominated culture. And it is good to see, you know, our sisters, you know, do their thing along those lines. And just with what Remy Ma said about Nicki Minaj, paraphrasing, of course, but needing to do a better job at representing Black girls, I believe that's true. I believe that hip hop will get to the place we want to go if we have more of this, where we're calling each other out, holding one another accountable.
Grand scheme, I've lately been getting into the Afrofuturist scene. So I've been listening to a lot of the internet and Janelle Monáe. And I'm kind of curious on what the artistic dialogue is like now between these Afrofuturist artists who are really kind of expanding not only the music, but like when I listen to internet, we're listening to a lesbian sister who's singing love ballads. And I just think that that expansion of sexual identity within the Black community is fantastic. So it's not only just about more voices of Black women in the music that are becoming more prominent and certainly more commercially marketable, but also these voices from different kind of gender identities and so forth and so on. So I'm kind of wondering what the dialogue is like with those artists and artists like yourself.
First of all, I love the internet. I think they're awesome. I think that hip-hop and that genre of music are very much alike. And as far as like the dialogue between the two, I think artistically what they've done is take elements of hip-hop and use it to build their genre. And what hip-hop is starting to do is absorb some of what's going on there too. I think anytime you can have that going on where we have dialogue between two different genres and the sexuality being expressed in an artistic way that's brand new and fresh, it's always good for the art. It provokes discussion, but it also gives us new perspectives and ways of thinking and absorbing our music and you know, being more accepting and exposed to things outside of our normal comfort zone. But I think it all goes to just expand what we've been trying to build this whole time.
I definitely find that refreshing. This is Shada. I find that refreshing because, you know, hip-hop is supposed to be a collective space that is inclusive, that allows people to organically cultivate their identity and to really push boundaries, right, societal constraints. So it is refreshing to see folks really be able to have that room to create that identity. But, you know, obviously the mainstream does not create that space for folks. So I really do find that the internet is doing a really good job breaking those barriers.
This question can go for Grand Scheme or you, Shada. So many people feel like celebrities have a responsibility to speak out against injustice, especially Black celebrities, because they are at the forefront of us. They are the face of us, celebrities, mainly artists and athletes, but artists specifically. And so a lot of people become upset and want to abandon a lot of people that they have followed because they didn't speak out or because they didn't speak out in the way that they did. How do you feel about that? And do you feel like it is their responsibility to speak, or are they just purely artists, focus on their artistry?
Definitely one major aspect of hip hop that is crucial when it comes to if you're joining that space is you definitely want to voice things that need to be surfaced. So when you say keep it real, you really do need to keep it real. You need to represent things that are going on and speak for the entire collective. If you have that platform to really articulate those ideas, then that is a responsibility, because hip hop is also spreading the message to the youth. So it's definitely critical. What do you think, Grand Scheme?
I believe the same. I believe we should use our platforms, if we have them down that level, to promote social change or at least to promote positivity. I look at Kaepernick as a great example of that, and that the brother was really just trying to make a political statement, but all the backlash he received was completely unexpected by me, but he did the right thing. At the end of the day, my whole thing about it was, as long as he follows up with actual attempts to make social change, then it's fine what he's doing. I don't think that we should rely too heavily on people in positions of celebrity to speak for us like we have done in the past, because, I don't know, it's just having fame doesn't necessarily mean you're saying anything that I need to hear. You know what I mean? I think what we should do is look within our own communities for those voices, or maybe even to be the change we wish to see in the world, and you know, just go about taking it upon ourselves to make those changes in our own environments. I do appreciate what a lot of celebrities have done lately, you know, with Snoop being mentioned earlier and Kaepernick and those of the like. But just for the most part, I do appreciate them using their platform for doing that. But we shouldn't rely so heavily on people just because they're famous to promote our message or, you know, bring about social change.
Grand Scheme, can you speak as an artist to maybe some of the boundaries that they do face, and they may want to speak out or they may want to say specific things or do specific actions, but again, they may not be underground, or they may be Beyonce or somebody huge who is either not wanting to jeopardize what they have or literally is not in a position to even speak to any of these issues. So you being an artist, have you experienced that, or can you speak to that?
Well, me, I'm totally underground, so I don't feel like I'm at risk of losing anything for speaking my mind, but I could definitely understand a person of higher stature, way up there, like a Beyonce, like you mentioned before, not wanting to risk what they have going or lose endorsements or not be able to make money going forward or be ostracized or blackballed from the industry. That is something that keeps a lot of people from speaking out. And like I said, again, Kaepernick is a good example of somebody who just kind of said, you know what, I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to lose some money. I'm going to, you know, donate and stuff like that in order to show that I care. But yeah, I think that's the reason we don't have more people speaking out, is because professionally it could be suicide. You know, you got to remember the people writing their checks, you know, are white males who probably really don't want that message out there. Yeah, it's an issue, but you know what? I'm all for anybody, you know, trying to promote social change by doing the right thing. And, you know, the more you have to risk, the more I commend you for doing so.
This is Shada. We definitely see a lot of rappers who enter into the industry. They usually start off following the whole glorification of gangster rap when they first get in. But then after they gain some sort of popularity, they really start to let go of that. And that's when they finally have that leverage to speak what's on their mind. But once they get into the industry, they have to follow what the industry wants. So people like J. Cole, he waited a while until he really started to emerge and start to get sociopolitical and like cultural. So J. Cole is one of them. Kendrick was like that too. We see a lot of that. There's like this evolution.
Grand Scheme, I'm wondering if we can get just one more quick verse from you, maybe just about a minute or two as we're wrapping up our segment.
Sure. I am everything everywhere. I speak the truth, so I'm never scared. I am what time under pressure becomes. These are the sentimental expressions from the mindful reflections of one. The beauty is in the intelligent design of it. Some people won't comprehend it till the right time cometh. But this is art manifesting itself to life's rhythm, using words to do much more than just rhyme with them. I take a mental picture, use dialect to frame it, then wait patiently for the dots to connect to name it. Sorta like I'm wrestling language, how I headlock it. 36 chamber that thing, chop and chest box it. Call that imagination, cause I think out of bounds, leaving the rest of the planet to split the common ground. The mainstream's equilibrium is off, unbalanced to where no realism is involved. But I got too much vision for that to matter though, cause my third eye's wide shut to the status quo. To me, the proof will always be in the poeticism, just like a truth will always be some of y'all never listen.
Thank you very much.
Amazing.
Thank you. Yes, amazing. Thank you, Grand Scheme, for joining us.
Thank you.
Shada Akbarian, I want to send a special thanks out to the great Desiree McSwain. It was a pleasure working with you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank
yes.
you.
This is Nick Bayham with the Project Censored Radio Show on Pacifica Radio.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Desiree McSwain and Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. We will be joined later by our intern and special announcer, Alicia Guajardo. So we got a lot of feedback rolling in on the Project Censored Show, both positive and negative. And if you want to send us your feedback, you can send me an email at nolanhigdonprojectcensored@gmail.com. The feedback was, of course, positive and negative. People think we're entertaining. They like the personalities, which is good. I've often said I think a lot of progressive radio is kind of sponsored by Ambien, so this is good that people find this somewhat entertaining. Of course, we had negative feedback, too, about too much insider jargon and those type of things, right?
Insider.
All right.
Insider jargon. I know. I didn't know we were on the inside. This feels good.
We'll take that to heart.
Yeah. Well, send us your feedback, and we'd love to talk about it on the Project Censored Show. You know, but I have to say that the comment about insider jargon reminded me of what I think is a problem in the Trump era, especially in like the communications, PR, corporate media sector. They constantly play to this like fifth, sixth grade mentality in their language. And on the one hand, I can see the argument of we want to be able to reach people. But on the other hand, it's like, how far do we go? I mean, I remember Chris Hedges years ago talked about how if you look back at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, they talked at like a 12th grade level. By the time we get to Kennedy, you're around like a 9th grade level. Clinton's around a 7th. And Bush and Obama talked to the American people around 5th, 6th grade.
Yeah.
So it's like, how low do we keep going before we say, no, I think we're going to talk at some like intellectual level. And I also think it's like partially kind of insulting. I think people who haven't had the access to this traditional education, I think they are curious and interested and do want to hear things. I don't think they want to be talked at it at some level. I don't know. What do you think? You think I'm wrong here?
I think you're in the 140 max character world of Twitter, the sort of Orwellian knowledge equals ignorance kind of world. I think that's where we're at.
I think it's partially also why we live in like this post-truth America. And I'm sorry to liberals. I know they're going to hate this, but I think we do need a war. I think we need a war on stupid. There's been a war on knowledge perpetuated by conservatives for just going on for decades now. This back to Reagan the era. And we now have Iowa who's trying to balance Democratic and Republican professors at their institutions of higher education. Not that there is any other perspective besides Democrats and Republicans, right? Arkansas is trying to ban Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Nick, for a long time, has been involved with union work, knows the destruction of tenure and dependence and exploitation of lecturers and adjuncts. But I think it's part of this larger cultivation of post-truth America. And I worry that by trying to dumb down what you say or not really get into these deeper concepts, you're sort of playing up into Trump America or post-truth America. And we saw that, too, with the NBA player Kyrie Irving, who believes the world is flat.
Couldn't tell if he was just putting people on with that, if he really means that.
That's a big movement that's been going on over and over, like B.O.B. the rapper and a couple other people. I don't know where it came from, but it's interesting that it's catching so much fire.
Yeah, I take it these guys have never taken a cruise, for example, in all likelihood.
I was actually getting interviewed for a student newspaper about a week or two ago, and during the interview, we're talking all these questions about media and all the research stuff I do. And one of the questions he asked was, do you think the world is flat? And I was just like, I paused. So I was like, do you mean like Thomas Friedman, like we're all connected flat?
Right.
Or like flat? But he's like, flat, flat. I was like, no, I've seen like the shadow during eclipse and ships come over horizons. So
pretty
confident.
But that's also part of the broader attack on science. We've got a guy, Dr. Ben Carson, who's leading housing and urban development, who's really there to dismantle housing and urban development. Allegedly, a brilliant surgeon, right? But at the same time, someone who doesn't believe in evolution, which it seems improbable as a scientist, as a surgeon, to hold those beliefs.
And this is unique in the world. There is no other country that has access to education like ours that has a political party that denies evolution and denies climate change.
That's correct.
This is not found around the world. I guess that is America and exceptionalism. But that kind of brings me to like the larger point of post-truth America, too. I mean, after Irving's comments, you had people come out and support and say, it's wonderful we live in a country where you can have these views and this. And that's partially true. But on the other hand, we also live in a democracy. It's really dangerous when you have people who just don't care about facts and just think they can say what they want. And because you're allowed to say it, it's equal to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So call it unenlightened or uninformed, misinformed, disinformed, whatever you want. It's problematic for the democratic process. And so I don't know. I think you feed into it by trying to meet these people in the middle.
There's some subtleties here, too. So there's not only this sort of post-truth space where our president continues to allege that the Trump Tower was bugged by Obama. I'm not really sure whether he means Obama had people bug it, or if Obama himself scaled Trump Tower like Spider-Man and placed the bugs himself. That allegation would not surprise me in the least. But there's also the world of distraction, right? So I've been lately really thinking about what happened when Rachel Maddow uncovered the tax return, and whether the 2 pages of tax return, which really didn't tell us much except how much Trump had earned in, I think it was 2005, whether that tax return was really substantive news or whether it distracted us from other things going on. Bad pieces of legislation, a brutal health care bill by the Republicans, ongoing acts of white supremacist violence in the name of Trump. So maybe you could help me work that out. I mean, on one level, I think that Rachel, who I very much respect, Rachel, who hails from Castro Valley, California, I think she's one of the brightest people on cable news. And by the way, that's not saying much. I think the bar is fairly low there. But while I respect her, was she setting this up as a prelude to more information? In other words, if there is a deep throat involved here who provided those tax returns, that deep throat certainly wanted to see that what would happen initially with the release of the 2 pages, and maybe feels assured now I can continue to release more material knowing that it's going to hit a national, international audience. So on the one level, maybe that's what was going on here. On the other level, was this just a total distraction? Was this sort of Rachel Maddow's? Remember that moment where they did the opening of the Capone vault and there was nothing there and it was a major television event? So was that sort of, you know, her moment like that?
I would agree. I think liberals have their own sort of problems here as well. Like you tune into someone like Maddow to say more negative things about Trump, which make you feel good. But there's a question of substance. Like, yeah, his tax returns, I mean, are semi-interesting, but in the grand scheme of the Trump era, they're so low on my list of things that actually matter. But she knew by pumping it up and creating a big spectacle around it, people would tune in. And I think, like you point out, it does a disservice. One, I think it does a disservice to all the things the left could be pointing out about Trump. And two, it does a disservice by distracting people from the real things we should be addressing in the era of Trump. And, you know, I have to ask, too, that one thing I think is interesting, though, to kind of throw in the mix here is we've seen this like almost academic belief that you can take down some of these false beliefs. Right. We saw a while back Milo was on Bill Maher's show and Bill Maher got accused of having soft interview skills. But Maher said, no, I let him speak his point and it'll sort of cave under its own weight. But then later on in the program, you had like Larry Wilmore really go after Milo. And we saw Susan Sarandon do the same after Chris Hayes about the Dakota Access Pipeline. I think that academic model doesn't work unless both sides agree that facts exist. And they're going to let the facts dictate the conversation. When you have one side who's going to just say things, emotion-based things, you can't engage in, I think, this academic style mm-hmm. of debate that's often promoted by Maher and others on those shows.
I mean, I love Maher, but let's face it, Maher doesn't read enough. And he doesn't read at depth. And I think that Larry Wilmore does. And frankly, I think Susan Sarandon does as well. And he's very caught up on particular issues, right? So you know that Bill Maher is really big about free speech. I think we all are. That's his thing. Pot is his thing, right? And I think we're on board with that too. I mean, he's got a couple of other little pet issues like that. And he continues to push them. And I think he got a little bit over-enamored with the free speech angle of Milo Yiannopoulos. And one of the things that I was upset with him about is that he's not able to critique the limits of free speech. So we understand that within a representative democracy, there actually is a limit to free speech. And that is when our free speech, or frankly any of our rights, impinge on the free exercise of the rights of our fellow citizens. Maher doesn't have the sophistication to really understand what that means.
No, I would agree completely. It's the vacuum way of thinking, right? Like only thinking about myself and my speech.
This is Desiree, and I just wanted to kind of piggyback on the earlier conversation about dumbing down a lot of the jargon that we have. And it's interesting because in doing so, not only do you water down a lot of facts, but it starts to become alternative facts where you have people like Ben Carson who call slaves immigrants now and stuff like that. And you're almost thinking about it, like you said, from a fifth to sixth grade level, how you would explain to a child slavery versus how you would explain to an adult the complex system of racism, white supremacy. So as adults and as educated adults, it's interesting that we are even wasting our time dumbing down things for people who are not here at that level yet, who have plenty of education, plenty of stuff that they can research and catch up. So I really don't feel like we should even waste our time dumbing it down. But again, that's just continuous arguments that we always get.
It really is devastating, isn't it, to sort of think about slavery as the new Ellis Island. It's fascinating to think about people who were enslaved as immigrants. Although I have to say, too, and you have to sort of forgive me here, to Carson's credit, there actually is a precedent for that. One of my critiques of the first run of Roots was that what I think Alex Haley did was he tried to sort of bring the story of his family within to this broader sort of immigrant story in the United States. But that had a lot to do with Haley's slight right of center politics. He was very much sort of an establishment, middle of the road guy. Mm. And this is also the reason why Haley neglects to really get into the more third world revolutionary perspective of Malcolm X in the autobiography and gives short shrift to the Organization of African American Unity and Muslim Mosque Incorporated. And to a degree, I think what Carson is really suffering from are the politics of black middle class respectability. I mean, I'm speaking as a member of the black middle class. I grew up in this context, and I guess for 51 years have been sort of fighting, you know, the things that come with that. But there's this real desire to want to be within that American tapestry of immigration and Ellis Island. But, you know, you keep going back to the truth of Malcolm X. I didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on me.
Yeah, and it's interesting you talk about, Desiree was talking about education as well. New Jersey, they just had students, classroom had students make slave posters in New Jersey.
Yes.
Came out recently.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's weird how that's trickling down. I think this goes back to the sophistication comment, both in the case of Carson and these posters. Perhaps in a sophisticated environment, you could have some reason to explain that. But there's this sort of vacuum of just doing, right?
Yeah, just doing.
You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Nolan Higdon, in studio with Nicholas Bayham III and Desiree McSwain. We'll be back after the musical break.
Welcome back to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Desiree McSwain in studio with my co-host, Nolan Higdon, and Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. And now we have our headlines with Alicia Huardo.
Hello, everyone. I am Alicia Huardo with the Media Freedom Foundation. Here are just some of the stories we are working on. Get over to gcml.org, where there are a series of proposals from students in Dr. Nolan Hignan's California State University East Bay classroom, which is also my school. The article explains a societal problem, discuss organizations working on those problems, and then offers solutions involving media. These students hope to get their proposals refined and supported, so go ahead and check them out. Also, Educating Our Way Out of Poverty was written by students Amber Abadia, Steve Christman, and Gabe Cox of California State University East Bay. They point out the relation between education and poverty, noting that education is a human right. Their proposal discussed how to get educators to collaborate in research underserved populations. It is titled Educating Our Way Out of Poverty and could be found at gcml.org. Also at gcml.org, students Samantha Ruzidis Buono, Alexandra Archuleta, and Daniel Torres of California State University East Bay published an article titled The Ice Tracker. It discusses the creation of an app to defend undocumented immigrants from federal agents. The proposal calls upon public institutions such as libraries and schools to offer access to digital tools to undocumented immigrants so they can access the app. This can also be found at gcml.org. The last proposal available at gcml.org is written by Rachel Potts, Raimundo Pedroza, and Kehlani Simmons, Scott Ault, and Cameron Stover of California State University East Bay. It is titled Homeless in a Digital Age. It discusses the problem of homelessness and how changing our media reporting and language can allow more people to understand the experience of homeless people, including college students, and how they can help alleviate the problem. You can find that at gcml.org. Over at projectcensor.org, you can find a chapter from Shahid Batar titled Ike's Dystopian Dream and How It Came True. The timely article discusses how President Dwight Eisenhower's warnings about our loss of privacy and military buildup at the expense of democracy have become true. You can find that article at projectcensor.org. I'm Alicia Guajardo, and that is the news that did not make the news. Is the calendar of events for the Media Freedom Foundation. On March 31st, Nolan Hignan and Mickey Huff will be in Sacramento, California at the Journalism Association of Community Colleges. On April 3rd, Mickey Huff, Mary Cardaris, and Nolan Hignan will be at Sonoma State University in Rohnert Park, California, as speakers for the third annual Social Justice Week. Mickey will be there all week as the keynote for Social Justice Week. On April 7th, Dr. Peter Phillips will be speaking at the Pacific Sociological Conference in Portland, Oregon. On April 20th, the PC crew, including Mickey Huff, Nolan Hignan, and numerous students will be in Walnut Creek, California for an event hosted by the Peace and Justice Center. Go ahead to projectcensor.org for more details. I'm Alicia Guajardo, and I hope to see you at Media Freedom events very soon.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nolan Hignan with Desiree McSwain and Nicholas Bayham III. Nikki Huff and Peter Phillips are our executive producers and hosts. Our intern and special announcer is Alicia Hardo. Anthony Fest, our producer, and Erica Bridgman, our engineer. The Project Censored show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S. Please follow us and like us on Facebook and visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all our radio shows for the past 6 years, as well as 40 years of news that didn't make the news. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitualized, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous, so the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, in the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential, fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu, we got that love, we flip the brothers in our system.